Ladies and gentlemen, there is a slight situation at hand. It turns out the regular host cannot make it this evening. This was due to an unfortunate goose-based incident at Highfields Park Lake. However, we have found a last-minute replacement who we trust will be even more to your liking. And now, please welcome to the stage for your delectation and delight, Miss Grasshopper Warbler. Hello, hello, darlings. Welcome to Slap the Chicken, and boy, what a night it is to welcome you all. Tonight it's all about the insects, baby, so settle back and listen up as we take you through the world of the tiny and the many-legged. I'm here with my lovely band to help me. So let's get started. I just need to walk to the other side of the stage so that you can get a full eyeball's worth of my gorgeous outfit. Take it away, boys. I don't know what that announcer at the start was talking about, but I'm here. I am here. Oh, the moustache? Well, I'll have you know that I'm a master of disguise. And for the record, I cannot outswim a goose. And that is facts. Now you and I had better have a chat about spider silk while Miss Warbler tries to get the band under control. Heaven help her. So, spider silk. What is it and what's it made out of? Well, there are 7 different types of silk that spiders can produce. There is no spider that is equipped to produce all 7 types of silk. The varieties they can make depend on how many spinnerets, which are the silk-producing organs they have on the underside of their abdomen. Each one of these spinnerets is dedicated to a different type of silk. These organs contain a sort of goo that the spider pulls out of the spinnerets with its back legs. This goo consists of proteins which have long chain structures which all link together when they are extracted from the spinnerets. The most familiar use of spider silk is, of course, the webs that some use to catch their prey. These can consist of 4 different types of spider silk based on strength, stickiness, and flexibility. First, the spider sketches out the spokes of the web using one type of silk before going over the design in stronger dragline silk. The spiral pattern is made of a stickier silk, which can stretch to nearly 3 times of its length before it snaps. That sticky elastic silk is then tied to the spokes of the web using the final 4th type of silk. A 5th type may be used to wrap the prey like cling film if the spider wants to save some for later or if it fancies a pasty. Spiders can either just sit around and wait for something to fall into the web or they can get a little more enterprising. The triangle weaver spider is so named because it weaves a web in the shape of a triangle. The silk it uses is very elastic, allowing the spider to stretch back one line of silk and catapult itself and the web onto an unsuspecting main course. When it does this, it can go from 0 to 1,722 miles per hour in 1 second. This is a G-force of about 78 G. Imagine, if you will, just minding your own business, and then 1 second later, you feel like you now have a mass of roughly 6 metric tons. That is what would happen if you tried to accelerate that fast, so take it off your to-do list for this particular evening, because, well, they've only just redecorated this bar. As it turns out, only about 50% of known spider species spin webs. However, all of them produce silk, so what would you say the other 50% used it for? Well, some use it to move around by a technique called ballooning. The spider climbs up as high as it can go and points its rear end upwards before sending out a load of silk threads. These threads act like a parachute, but because the spider isn't heavy enough to counteract the air pushing it upwards, it is sent soaring off into the sky, flying off to some new home, which could be several kilometres away. I mean, it must be confusing for the spider. One minute your rear's in the air, next minute you're in Coventry. Anyway, another common use is wrapping for spider eggs to keep them nice and insulated. This uses yet another type of silk. Sometimes an adult spider will use silk to make a kind of sleeping bag with a hole in it so it can peek out while it sleeps. The diving bell spider has a unique use for its web, which you may be familiar with if you've ever been swimming in a t-shirt. If you lift your shirt up above the water and bring the material down onto the surface as you go down beneath the water, an air bubble will be trapped between the shirt material and the surface of the water. This is exactly what the diving bell spider does, except it uses its web because, well, when was the last time you saw a shop selling the right size shirts for spiders? It's a big problem. A lot of the research around spider silk focuses on the material properties such as tensile strength, lightness and flexibility to create fibres that are lighter, better, faster, stronger. You know, the drill. However, spider silk also has medical applications. It can be used within the body without adverse side effects. The Greeks and Romans used to put it in and around wounds, and they found that the silk helped the wounds to heal. It was in 2017 that researchers here at the University of Nottingham created synthetic spider silk that could be used as an antibiotic dressing. The way it worked was by making the protein goo that you find in spider spinnerets and then putting in one extra type of protein which you could attach the antibiotic agent to. This protein goo was then made into a fibre which could be used as a dressing which would not only release antibiotics into the wound, but provide a structure for tissue regrowth if the wound was open.
Excuse me, it's a girl at the back. Prattling about arachnids at an insect-only event, are we?
Yes, Mum.
Ah, an imposter. Security, get her out. And... oh, get that pigeon out of here whilst you're at it. Thank you, Kieran, love.
Ow.
Speaking of unwanted things, our next performance tonight shall be about computer bugs. Van, do you know what to do?
1, 2, 3, 4.
It's a tasty snack. You can eat it all at once and you can keep it back. It is suitable for breakfast, tea or lunch, because I don't like that circle crunch.
I guess they're badly wrong. So let me tell you the cold hard truth about this. A computer bug is a flaw in the computer system which makes it behave badly, essentially. This term was coined by researchers at Harvard in 1947 when they were experiencing persistent problems with an early computer called the Mark II. After searching through about 50 feet of valves and switches, they found the problem. That problem was an adventurous moth, which ended up sellotaped to their logbook for prosperity. computer bugs are not inherently bad, unlike a virus or any other type of malware. Computer bugs are just a sort of mistake. The computer will still work, the software will still work, but just not quite in the way that you want it to. In contrast to malware, which is software specifically designed to harm your computer, a virus is a type of malware which is so named because it acts on a computer like a real virus does on your cells. It gets inside and makes it act up, replicates itself, and spreads on to the next victim. One such naughty little creature of a computer bug was the Y2K bug. As a new millennium was about to roll around, computer developers faced a big problem. Since pretty much all of the development of modern computer technology had occurred in the 20th century, the way in which years were recognised by the computer was by looking at the last two digits of the number and assuming that the first two were 1 and 9. For instance, the computer would see 91 stored as a date type saying that it's a year and assume that it meant the year 1991. So, what was going to happen when the last two digits were 00? Would it assume that the year was 1900? Either way, this was a little worry for anything that used software involving dates. I mean, this was only the stock market, food distribution systems, banking computers, insurance computers, even lifts, temperature control systems leading to economic collapse and food shortages and starvation and the apocalypse. Yeah, this needed sorting out and quickly. The UN had a conference in 1998 to figure out an international relief plan in case of a major crisis brought on by this bug. After a lot of work behind the scenes to upgrade the software, the 1st of January 2000 rolled around with hardly any problems. Little did the world know, however, that something even more threatening to modern civilization and world peace as we know it would be born that very November. Disclaimer: some of you may have heard of the Y2K aesthetic named after this bug and largely involving dressing like all of the Spice Girls at once. This is not vintage, as some claim, because the year 2000 was not that long ago. The year 2000 was not that long ago, and people born in that year are deserving of love and happiness. They are happy and accepted. I am the creator of my own anxiety. Some bugs which are less serious, but still annoying, are the ones found in video games. Developers will regularly release patch notes or release notes, which is a list of all the things that have happened to the game in the latest update, including user-reported bugs which have now been fixed. It is worth noting that this next section comes from somebody whose gaming skills extend to breeding Minecraft chickens and getting consistently destroyed in Mario Kart whenever I go to somebody's house. So buckle in as we go for an adequate assessment of your moral compass based on what game developers have fixed. Now let's say a squid came up to you. Would you attempt to get milk out of it? Your answer should be no, at least according to the developers of Minecraft who had to remove this feature. It came from creating the squid from the cow model and forgetting to remove the squiddy milkers. Other things you should have the answer no to is whether a teddy bear should levitate when put down, The Sims 2, or whether you should have a baby with death himself, from The Sims 3. So how do you go about getting rid of them? Prevention tends to be better than cure, so a good strategy when writing code is to use defensive programming. This is where you create your code assuming that the worst may happen, such as dealing with pieces of data that are too big or not of the right type. Bugs can also be pinpointed whilst writing the code by writing it incrementally or bottom up. This is where you test whether the code works after every few lines you write, so you write it in increments. If all of a sudden your code has a problem, then the problem must be in the bits you've just written. These aren't terribly useful if you have already written a massive block of code, so what next? A binary search may be used to find problems. This involves splitting the code in half and testing one of the halves. If the problem doesn't appear in that half, it must be in the other one. You keep cutting the pieces of code in half until you zero in on the error. If all else fails, you may also like to try rubber duck debugging. This involves explaining your code and what you think it should be doing to a small rubber duck. Explaining your troubles aloud often helps to pinpoint the source of issues. You could also do this with a friend instead of a duck, but really? In this economy? Very unrealistic. Oh, security are back again. Let's hide somewhere else. I'll be outside. Oh, I'm sorry, I assume all of your conversations are more important than my show. Well, I'm going, and I expect double pay by tomorrow morning or I'm contacting my lovers. Hey, Garson, Harvey, dear, I'm down out of the stainless though so that she can't get over here. That's what you want too, right? Is it? Behold the chaos. Sometimes problems with computers may lead to other discoveries about that which lies beneath the surface. It's time for the butterfly effect. So, what is chaos? Well, first we need to figure out what a deterministic system is. This is a system where the outcome can be determined using the equations which describe the system mathematically. For example, let's say we've got a system which is an isolated box of particles. The equations in this case would be some form of Newton's laws which tell you the velocity and acceleration of each particle. This would mean that in theory you could figure out how the system was going to evolve with time based upon how you'd set the initial conditions. This was what Edward Lorentz thought in the 60s when he was trying to predict the weather. It was assumed that if you could figure out accurately the state of the weather system right now, you could mathematically predict how the weather would move and change for as far into the future as you liked. After a previous run, he decided to take some data from halfway through that run and start a new simulation from halfway through the process. It was assumed that because the system was deterministic, the weather would change in exactly the same way that it had done in the first run. However, the data he put in was rounded, so the weather changed in a different way. This you would expect because, well, 3.50 is not the same number as 3.54, so a different number would give a different result, right? But you wouldn't expect this different result to be too far off the first result, because the number has only been changed by a very tiny amount. This is where things got interesting, because the forecast that Lorentz got out from the second run was almost completely different. A tiny change in initial conditions produced a huge change in the way the system changed eventually, like the movement of air from butterflies' wings setting off a storm halfway across the world. Hence, the butterfly effect. A way in which chaotic behaviour may be analysed is by plotting the system's changing state in phase space. Coordinates just serve as a way to keep track of something relative to a starting point. For instance, if you set that start point as 0, the horizontal axis as x and the vertical axis as y, then you could say a point is 5 horizontal steps and 3 vertical steps away from the starting point of 0 by giving it the coordinate 5, 3. Phase space uses a coordinate system which allows you to keep track of the state of a system over time relative to a starting point. So the first state could be 5 steps in phase space away from the initial state. This can be done if the state can be described mathematically by the position and momentum of the particles involved. For instance, our weather system could be characterized by the position and momentum of the air particles that make up the air currents. Now, this system will have regular occurrences of states, such as the occurrences of rainfall or tropical storms. This results in a plot with a surprisingly well-defined shape. In Lorenz's case, this looks like a butterfly or a pair of oyster shells, which are open and rounded. However, the same system state will never occur twice, meaning that none of the points on this shape will ever overlap, no matter how long you observe it over time. A pattern with no repetition within it is rather strange, which is why this plot is known as a strange attractor. It is also fractal, meaning that if you zoom in on the shape, you find that it's made up of several copies of the same shape. Funky stuff. Well, that's all I have to say about that. I need to leave before they all come out of their window. Next time, we're talking about sound. So I hope you'll come along, and I hope that the gossip will get you better. Well, you know, it's raining again. It's big soon. Just in case.